Memory Palace. Memory Palace.
Right now, your brain is quietly editing the memory of what I just said. And by the time this episode ends, you'll remember parts that never happened while forgetting details you'd swear you'd never lose. I'm Joe Hoster, and welcome to Memory Palace, where we explore the beautiful, broken, and utterly fascinating ways your mind creates the story of your life. Welcome to Memory Palace. Memory Palace.
Have you ever found yourself in a moment of decision? Maybe a big one. Maybe something as simple as what to have for dinner. And you get this flicker of a past experience, a gut feeling that's not really a feeling, but more like an echo.
That echo is precisely why I'm so compelled by what we're discussing today. As a writer, I live in the space of why characters make the choices they do. And more often than not, the answer isn't in the present moment. It's buried in a memory, sometimes one they don't even consciously recall. It's that ghost in the machine that dictates the path forward.
Exactly. For me, it's less about characters on a page and more about the choices I see people, and myself, make every day. I've always been fascinated by how two people can face the exact same set of facts and walk away with completely different decisions. The only variable, it seems, is the library of experiences they're each carrying inside them.
And that's the door we're opening today. We're not just talking about choices. We're exploring the invisible architecture that memory builds within our minds. An architecture that guides our hands, our words, and our lives, often without our permission or even our awareness.
So the question we want to leave you with, to hold in your mind as we begin this journey, is a simple one. When you make a choice, are you acting or are you reacting to a memory you've long since forgotten?
That question is, it's really the core of it all. Because for a huge portion of our lives, especially when we're young, that line between acting and reacting is almost non-existent. It's all reaction. We think of teenage rebellion or rash decisions as a character flaw, but the architecture you mentioned earlier, in an adolescent brain, it's still under construction. And one part is being built way faster than the other.
Oh. So it's not just a lack of experience, it's an actual structural imbalance?
Precisely. For years, the thinking was that adolescents were simply incompetent decision makers, that they lacked logic. But the research now is so clear. They can be just as competent as adults in a sterile, logical environment. The problem is, life is rarely sterile and logical.
Right. You introduce psychosocial factors. You introduce peer pressure or emotion.
And the whole system gets hijacked. There are two key brain networks at play here, the socio-emotional network and the cognitive control network.
Okay, so socio-emotional is gut feelings, rewards, what our friends think.
Exactly. It processes social stimuli, emotional highs and lows, and crucially, it's central to reward processing. Then you have the cognitive control network. That's the planner, the CEO in the prefrontal cortex that handles self-regulation and thinks about long-term consequences.
The adult in the room.
The adult in the room, yes. But here's the issue. During puberty, that socio-emotional, reward-seeking network undergoes this rapid, supercharged development. It's like going from a go-kart to a Formula One car overnight.
But the cognitive control network, dot.
It's still learning to drive. It matures much more gradually. So you have this incredibly powerful emotional engine and a braking system that's, let's say, not quite up to the task yet.
So it's not that the teen can't make the logical choice. It's that the shouting from the reward-seeking part of the brain is just too loud. The potential reward of, say, peer acceptance feels more real and immediate than the potential risk.
It feels infinitely more real. And this is where it gets fascinating and a little scary. The brain's response to these risky high arousal situations, it starts to mirror the process of addiction.
Addiction? That's a strong word.
But it's accurate. They take a risk, they get a huge internal reward from their brain chemistry, and often an external reward from peer approval. That loop reinforces itself. The behavior becomes more probable. They're literally chasing that high, just like in substance addiction.
Wow. That completely reframes how you look at that kind of behavior. It's not just being dumb, it's a neurological trap.
It is. And to make it even more potent, there's another bias at play. Recent studies show that adolescents have a harder time than adults adjusting their beliefs in response to bad news.
Wait, what do you mean?
If you give them good news, they'll update their beliefs just like an adult. Hey, you're more likely to succeed than you thought. They absorb that. But if you tell them, watch out, this is more dangerous than you think, they don't integrate that information as effectively.
So, they hear the good, but discount the bad. It creates this skewed, overly optimistic view of the world. No wonder they feel invincible. It's not just an attitude. It's baked into how they process information.
Baked in is the perfect way to put it. It's a feature, not a bug, of that developmental stage. And that invincibility you mention? It gets a turbo boost from one specific factor, the mere presence of other teenagers.
Oh, of course. The audience. It's not enough to take the risk. You have to be seen taking the risk.
It's more neurological than even that. Lawrence Steinberg did these landmark studies with a driving simulation game. When an adolescent is in the room by themselves, they take about the same number of risks as an adult. They drive pretty safely.
Okay, so they have the capacity for good judgment. The hardware is there.
The hardware is there. But then they bring two of the team's friends into the room just to watch. They don't say anything. They don't cheer. They just sit there.
Let me guess. The number of risks they take, it skyrockets.
It doubles. Doubles. They run more yellow lights, they speed, they crash more often. And the most telling part, when you do the same thing with adults, bring their friends in to watch, it makes no difference whatsoever to their performance.
Wow. So it's not just peer pressure in the active sense, like someone daring you. It's a biological reaction to being observed by your tribe. The socio-emotional network just lights up and takes over the controls.
It completely hijacks the system. The potential reward of social approval, even imagined social approval, outweighs the concrete risk of crashing the car. The cognitive control network, the CEO, is basically told to go sit in the corner while the party happens.
That's actually terrifying, because you think about the decisions made in those moments, and those aren't just memories that fade. They become foundational. They're the stories you tell about yourself, the experiences that build your identity. They become the pillars in that memory palace we talked about.
They become the reference points. When a similar situation arises years later, even in a different context, what's the echo you hear? It's the echo of that time you took the risk and were rewarded with laughter and admiration from your friends. Not the echo of the near miss you had at the intersection.
Because you're wired to ignore the bad news, as you said. So the memory that gets encoded, the one that gets polished and put on a pedestal, is the one where the reward felt amazing. The danger just becomes ancillary detail, a footnote to a great story.
And think about what that does. It creates a feedback loop that extends far beyond adolescence. You build a decision-making framework on a set of memories that are fundamentally skewed towards rewarding risk. You learn a pattern. And unlearning that pattern as an adult, when the stakes are so much higher, that's incredibly difficult.
So the ghost in the machine isn't just a single memory. It's the entire operating system that was coded when the emotional engine was redlining and the brakes were barely installed. And we carry that code with us for the rest of our lives, often without ever realizing it's running in the background.
And that's the real crux of it. We're not just talking about a series of poor choices in the past. We're talking about the very calibration of our decision-making compass. It was set during a neurological storm, and for many of us, we never think to check if it's still pointing true north.
So then the big question, the one that's kind of hanging in the air for me, is, are we just stuck with that? Is that teenage ghost forever at the wheel, and we're just passengers pretending we have control?
I don't think so. I hope not. I think the first step is just this, the awareness. Realizing that when you feel that irrational pull towards a risky choice, maybe it's a financial gamble, maybe it's a relationship decision, that feeling isn't necessarily a true signal about the present. It might just be an echo from a time when your brain was supercharged to value the reward over the risk.
So you can learn to recognize the echo, to say, ah, okay, that's the old programming running. That's the 16-year-old in the driving simulator with his friends watching.
Exactly. You can't delete the code, but you can learn to recognize it. And that moment of recognition, that creates a sliver of space. And in that space, the cognitive control network, the adult in the room, finally has a chance to be heard over the shouting.
You know, it's interesting you put it that way. I'm not sure I see it as something to override necessarily. Maybe it's more about integration. That reward-seeking, risk-taking drive isn't just a flaw. It's also the engine of exploration, of creativity, of falling in love. It's what makes us try things that have no guarantee of success.
That's a really good point. You don't want to extinguish that fire. You just want to build a better fireplace around it so it doesn't burn the house down.
Right. It's about balance. It's about knowing which voice is speaking. Is it the voice of experience and wisdom, or the ghost of a teenager who just wanted to look cool in front of his friends? And maybe realizing that both have something to offer, if you listen correctly.
So, in the end, that question we started with, are you acting or are you reacting to a forgotten memory? The answer is probably yes. It's always both. The past is always present. The goal isn't to escape it, but to understand its architecture. To walk through our own memory palace and see what's truly holding up the walls.
A beautiful way to put it. I suppose the final thought is just that. The next time you face a choice and you feel that gut pull, just take a second. Ask yourself where the echo is coming from. Thank you for walking through the palace with us.
The next time you're certain you remember something exactly as it happened, remember this. Your memory isn't a recording. It's a reconstruction. And every time you access it, you change it. That's not a bug in the system. It's the feature that makes us human. Until next time, trust your memory, but verify everything else.